I'm Mark Simpson, and this is Intersection. Florida is still facing the highest rate of foreclosure in the nation. Why are other states improving while Florida lags? I put that question to the Secretary of the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development, Sean Donovan. We'll also talk about the role of HUD in promoting good housing design around Sunrail. Also, as part of Intersection's five-year anniversary, we listen back to an interview with local World War II veteran Bill Coleman. Those conversations ahead on Intersection. Florida's foreclosure crisis is still very real. The state holds the highest rate of foreclosure of any in the nation. I spoke with HUD Secretary Sean Donovan as he visited Orlando last week on the way to the Florida Housing Coalition's annual conference. Mr. Secretary, welcome to Intersection.
It's great to be with you.
So we're speaking as you're off to address the Florida Housing Coalition's annual conference. Last month, though, CoreLogic reported that Florida still has the highest rate of foreclosure in the nation, around 11%. And I wonder, what do you think is keeping that rate so high?
Well, first of all, the good news is that we are making progress. The number of families that are behind on their mortgages continues to drop. The number of families that are underwater is down by over 250,000 from where it was a year ago in Florida. But there is a problem that remains on foreclosures. They're overall down about a third from where they were 2 years ago, but we've seen a tick up recently. And one of the problems, frankly, is we found such pervasive problems in the way that banks were foreclosing, in some cases not even reading the documents before they completed foreclosures. I mean, this is taking away the single most important asset that most families will ever have, literally without reading the documents. And so we went in, did investigations. In many cases, the foreclosure process stopped or substantially slowed down because of that. So what we've seen, we reached a settlement earlier this year, the largest joint state-federal settlement in the history of the country, which is bringing $25 billion of help to homeowners around the country. We've already seen over 27,000 homeowners in Florida get help in the last few months. But we're also seeing some slight increase in foreclosures as a result of that. We also see Florida has one of the slowest foreclosure processes in the country. And so in some cases, you have folks who may have entered foreclosure a year or two ago who are just seeing the completions now. Everywhere else, foreclosures are dropping much faster than they are in Florida.
Yeah, I wondered if you might talk about that a little bit. It has to do with the process that Florida actually has compared to, say, states in the West, which might attribute to why they're seeing improvement faster.
Well, let's be careful here, though, because we don't want to suggest that a fast process is necessarily a good process. The process has to be done right. Frankly, again, what you're talking about here is taking away the single most important asset most families are ever going to have. And so we need to make sure there is a process that ensures that families have every chance to keep their home before they end up going through foreclosure. So I don't think that having a longer process is necessarily a bad thing if it's a process that ensures families don't get evicted from their homes, have their homes taken in a bad process, which, frankly, we saw too often during the crisis.
You mentioned that $25 billion national mortgage settlement, and in Florida, more than 1,000 homeowners have seen their average debt reduced by more than $100,000. Is that a good number for a state that's still topping the nation in terms of foreclosure rate?
Well, that's the number that were completed. There were an additional about 4,000 homeowners who started what we call trial modifications for principal reductions. Just to be clear, we didn't want to make sure that we were holding these banks' feet to the fire. And so what we said is, if you're going to reduce principal and get credit for it, you have to do it in a way that actually is keeping somebody in their home. We don't want you to reduce their principal and the next day they're thrown out of the house. And so what we said is, families have to be paying successfully for at least 90 days in order for that to count toward the settlement. So there's thousands of more homeowners that are getting that principal reduction, and their payments have already been lowered, but the banks haven't gotten credit for it yet. So what I would say overall is I am cautiously optimistic that these early results are positive. And I believe, given the very strong monitoring that we have in place, the way that we can find the banks, that we will get what was promised under the settlement. But the settlement is only one piece of a broader puzzle. And we need to make sure that there are other things that are helping reduce families' payments, encouraging principal reduction. And in fact, as we reach the settlement, we also put in place a whole range of other policies that will help more families get principal reduction and also, frankly, help more families that are current on their mortgages be able to get refinancing. That's one of the biggest challenges we face when we still have many families underwater in Florida.
Do you feel like the housing market in the industry really has turned a corner, or is there still a rough road ahead?
Well, there is no question that what we are seeing both here in Central Florida and across the country is encouraging in terms of recovery. Whether it's the 8% increase in home prices that we've seen in this area over the last year, whether it's the more than 250,000 homeowners across Florida that have gotten back above water in the last year, the lower number of delinquencies and families falling into foreclosure, all those are positive signs. But we still have too many families that are underwater. And that's why the president is pushing hard to make sure that Congress takes additional steps to help homeowners. One of the things we put in place last year for government-insured mortgages, so that's a Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac, FHA mortgage, we made it dramatically easier to refinance, particularly for homeowners that were underwater. They had been locked out. And when I say underwater, I mean the value of your home is less than your mortgage. And that locked many families, millions of families across the country, out from refinancing. We made a series of changes last year. Long story short, we've seen the number of refinancing applications in Florida triple. We saw a dramatic increase, 8 times higher level of deeply underwater homeowners refinancing this summer because of those changes. But we still have many families that are locked out. Most families don't even know if they have a government-guaranteed mortgage. You ask someone, do you have a Fannie mortgage or a Freddie mortgage? They don't know. What they know is they're making their payments every month. They're on time on their mortgage. And yet, even though they're the lowest interest rates in the history of the country, we don't have the opportunity for them to refinance. And so that's something that we need to make sure happens. There's a bill, set of bills in front of Congress in the next few weeks that we want to make sure get passed.
You mentioned that. The 4 bills we're trying to get passed that have to do with housing, first two addressing helping families who are current on those mortgages and want to refinance, lower the fees associated with refinancing, and other two to help rebuild lost equity. What do you think in terms of getting these measures passed through? You're in election season, lame duck sessions coming up. What's the outlook in terms of passage?
Well, what I would tell you is in normal times, I wouldn't need to be here on the radio or at conferences urging Congress to act. In fact, a broad coalition of organizations from industry players like the realtors, the mortgage bankers, the Housing Policy Council, and advocates like the Center for Responsible Lending and a whole range of others endorsed the Menendez-Boxer bill, one of the 4 bills, the very first that we expect to come up. And so that's the kind of broad support, typically bipartisan support, you would see for something like this. And one of the reasons is this isn't just good for individual families. The average family can save about $3,000 a year by refinancing. It's like a significant tax cut. But it's also good for their neighbors. When you have fewer foreclosure signs going up because payments are lower, that means everybody's home values do better. Because as soon as a foreclosure sign goes up next door, even if you're paying your mortgage, your own home goes down about $10,000 in value. And lastly, this is good for the economy. Economists, Glenn Hubbard, who's a senior advisor to Mitt Romney's campaign, was the most senior economic advisor to President Bush. He recommends that we expand refinancing. He's one of a broad range of economists because it's so important for consumer spending. When you have millions of families saving $3,000 a year, that boosts consumer spending. Families take that money, they spend it at the local restaurant, they spend it fixing up their house. all of those things create jobs, and we haven't seen the kind of boost that we would otherwise see from refinancing because too many families have been locked out.
What do you think, though, about perhaps a generation of young people seeing what their families and other homeowners are going through, maybe scarred from the idea of even going in down the route of home ownership and being long-term renters? If you've got people that are affected by that generationally and say, you know, I don't want to get involved with that, doesn't that create a bump then that's going to be coming up, and then you're into some whole other perhaps problem?
Yeah. Well, you know what's interesting, Mark, is we're not seeing that in surveys. And frankly, I might have expected a little bit more. We still see broadly more than 3/4 of Americans say that they aspire to owning a home. So the lesson I take from this is we need to have a more balanced housing policy. We need to make sure that we're focusing on rental housing as well as home ownership. And we have to make sure that families are making the right choices. We sponsor housing counseling across the country. We know that when families get help from a housing counselor, they make better decisions about whether to become a homeowner, when to become a homeowner, and when they do make that leap, they're ready. We also see that families who get into trouble are more likely to keep their homes when they use a counselor. So that's one key thing that we want to do more of.
Do you think everybody should be a homeowner?
This is very much about what's right for an individual family. And as I said earlier, we should have a more balanced housing policy. I think that's an individual decision that families ought to make. What I think our responsibility is, what President Obama thinks the responsibility of the federal government is to make sure that when consumers take that incredibly important step, that they're protected. That's why he fought so hard to create a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You know, in some ways, Mark, before this crisis, families had more protections when they bought a toaster than when they made the single most important financial decision of their lives to buy a home and take a mortgage. And so that's why the president fought for a Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. It's why he has a homeowner bill of rights that we've put forward. Part of that homeowner bill of rights has been put in place by this settlement that we talked about earlier, which says, hey, when a family owns a home and they get into trouble, they lose a job or they get fewer hours, they have a medical emergency, they ought to be protected and get help to stay in their home. That's good for the family. It's also good for the lender and for the economy if we can help families that actually can pay continue to stay in their homes.
I'm talking with Sean Donovan. He's the Secretary for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. This is Intersection, and you're listening to 90.7 News. One of the interesting stories to come out of the foreclosure crisis is that in certain parts of Florida around Coral Springs, we're seeing some homes in gated communities now being used for Section 8 housing, which is a rent assistance program. Do you think – is that beneficial, and do you think that could continue since we have so many of those gated communities in Florida?
Well, broadly speaking, we have to be creative about how we use these homes. We've now invested through the Obama administration about $1 billion across Florida to take – vacant and abandoned homes, renovate and rebuild them. That's put tens of thousands of people back to work. Construction was one of the hardest hit industries. And it's presented an opportunity for rethinking the use of some of these homes. And so I think creative uses like that are important. And one of the things that I think that shows, one of the places we've failed in the past in our housing policy is too often we've concentrated the lowest income residents in neighborhoods that have poor schools, that have maybe high crime, that lack access to good jobs. And so by helping families move to neighborhoods where their kids can go to a good school, where they can get better access to jobs, those are all positive steps that will help everybody, because we have the most competitive economy that we've had maybe in the history of the country. China, India, Brazil are all competing like they haven't before. We got to have everybody on the playing field in this country. We've got to make sure that low-income Americans whose kids may have been locked out of decent schools, not had a chance to achieve their potential, we need to help them achieve their potential by helping them live in neighborhoods of opportunity.
You know, in Florida, we have so much suburban sprawl as well as some pockets of very walkable places. But in many locations, there's not a lot of access to green spaces or easy ways to get around without using your car. And 2 years ago, you were talking about using location efficiency to evaluate projects and maybe try to stop the spread of sprawl. Where does that stand?
Well, one of the most important initiatives we have here in the Orlando area, we've been working very closely with Mayor Dyer, who's just been a terrific mayor. He has been very focused on creating, through SunRail, alternatives for families to be able to get to jobs faster and ultimately to grow the economy. And so the problem is, if you just put in the rail line, you're not going to get the benefits that could come with this. What you have to do is make sure that around those stations for SunRail, there are 12 stations, you have the zoning in place that will increase the amount of construction that happens. That creates more jobs, but also locate housing and jobs within a walkable distance from those stations. That requires real planning. We've been funding comprehensive plans for 6 of those 12 SunRail stations. And that's an enormously important initiative to help create the ability for Orlando to continue to grow. Frankly, families are getting more and more fed up, whether it's, you know, I have 2 young kids, they're 13 and 10. I don't want to be spending 2 hours every day commuting. I want to be home with them. And frankly, the cost of commuting, the average family now in America now spends over 50 cents of every dollar they earn just on housing and transportation. So this is the kind of smart investment through SunRail that can both lower the cost of commuting, but also bring more jobs because companies want to locate in places where their workers want to be and where it's easier for them to get to their jobs.
Is that a contradiction, though, with wanting the average American person? They ideally want to have their own single-family dwelling, and a lot of these places around rail stops or apartments or townhouses, that sort of kind of more densely packed living. Is that a contradiction in what the American spirit wants, though, in terms of home ownership?
Yeah, Mark, you know, what's interesting is we've seen more and more families these last few decades. As cities have become a more attractive places to live, crime has gone down, schools have gotten better. Families are actually moving back into cities. And that doesn't mean everybody's going to make that choice. But we're seeing more and more families make a decision. Hey, I may give up a little bit of that lawn. I may give up a little bit of space because I can walk to school with my son or my daughter. I can walk down the street to a restaurant. I can live in a place where many of the things that I want to do every day are accessible to me. And frankly, where I'm not spending an hour or two in my car every day, not seeing my kids or you know, getting frustrated just sitting in traffic. And that's the cost of that, as well as the benefits just from, you know, a family perspective, are enormously important. And so more and more families are making that choice to live in denser environments.
Florida's got a big senior population, big aging population, retirement communities. What is HUD able to do for providing more affordable senior housing? Because we're seeing more and more people live longer, their incomes are lower, they can't drive, they can't get out.
Yeah, Mark, this is an incredibly important question, and it's going to grow in importance over time. One of the things we're doing, frankly, is just investing more in senior housing. We've become very innovative in finding ways, particularly for our lowest income seniors, to build apartments that have the things that they need. Oftentimes what we find is just having a single person in the building, what we call a service coordinator, whose sole job is to say, hey, you're having trouble driving. How are we going to get your groceries? You need to get your medication. Is there a place that's walkable? Can we make sure? Or if not, how can we arrange making sure that we get prescriptions, maybe with deliveries or drop-offs or other things? So that kind of service coordinator is an incredibly important thing. One of the things we also find, though, we're spending a huge amount of taxpayer money for nursing homes and very institutional forms of care that are very expensive. Often what we find, if we have the right kind of help available in an apartment building, like a service coordinator, seniors are happier because they get to stay in their homes longer. They don't want to move into a nursing home. They want to stay closer to their families. They want to stay closer to their friends. And they can stay longer. And, by the way, we save money because it's much less expensive to pay for a service coordinator than it is for all of the needs in a nursing home. And that's something, you know, the president's been very focused on making sure we protect seniors and to lower the cost of healthcare over the long term. That's something that can be a real benefit through these smart kind of investments, which limit the need for nursing homes and assisted living, but also keep families closer together, keep seniors in their communities.
Sean Donovan is the Secretary for the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. He stopped by on his way to address the Florida Housing Coalition's annual conference. Secretary Donovan, thanks so much for your time.
Great to be with you, Mark.
Coming up, as part of Intersection's five-year anniversary series, we listen back to a conversation with local World War II veteran Bill Coleman, who parachuted into France as a member of the 101st Airborne Division on D-Day. That's ahead on 90.7 News. One of my most interesting conversations from Intersection's first year was in 2007 with World War II veteran Bill Coleman. He was a member of the 101st Airborne Division and parachuted into France on D-Day. So, Bill, you jumped out of the plane. How did it go from there?
Couldn't have been any worse. The problem was, and this, you have to envision this if you can, those flying the aircraft were 17, 18, 19-year-old, and so were the paratroopers. And in the airplane, we had a signal, just like a signal light, a caution light, yellow, and then a green light, and I mean a red light, and we had red, caution, and green. And as we were getting ready to jump up, it occurred to us that this is not the way it's supposed to be, because we found out that the aircraft had radio silence, they couldn't talk to each other, and they had no navigational lights. And it was so overcast that they couldn't even see where the others were. So, unfortunately, a couple of them did crash into each other, and down went everybody on those. Each of those guys say, I want to get out of here, and they gained altitude or peeled off to the right or left and lost altitude to get below so they could see where they were going. And the next thing we knew, we had the green light. We didn't get the other two to get out of here. Well, you could hear the things pinging into the aircraft and coming through, and a couple of guys got kind of a little piece of it, and you could hear them say, let out a whooping by the time they got it. But that guy hit the green light, and we were out of there. Now, I had cradled my rifle, and I had also a helmet on that had me where I could hardly speak. And that opening shock, that when you reach the end of the static line, it pulls the backpack off, was such that I lost my rifle and my helmet. And I only did about two oscillations and landed on my back on the ground.
Well, I mean, was it a surreal experience coming down? I mean, did you see things getting bigger as you're coming down and start to think, oh, man, what am I landing in here?
No, I had no thought of that at all. I was just, it was such chaotic confusion that there was nothing to concentrate on except survival. And there was nothing you could do to even do that. I got hit a couple of times coming down.
By people shooting at you.
Oh, yeah. There were tracers going all over the place, and they had some kind of a spray bomb that throw out stuff that explode like a
shrapnel
thing. And then they had anti-aircraft firing away as well. And you didn't have time to concentrate on what's going on. It's just training is the only thing I think that really took over and for every one of us.
So you landed down on the ground. What was that landing like? And when you got there, what was the plan?
Well, we had each of us had a knife in our boot, because the old chutes that we had double metal lockers across the chest and across the legs, and they were the toughest thing in the world to get in and out of. So they just said, take your knives and cut your way out of that. And that, I had done that, and I was standing up. And another thing that was, they were issued crickets, and we were supposed to, and they said, do not fire a shot until daylight so that you would not be shooting each other, and to be sure that you're dealing with your own people, we have this system. You cricket, and then I cricket. Then you say flash, and I say thunder, and you say welcome. Now, there were 3 days they told us we'd be there. Didn't turn out that way. And we had the same thing for the three different days. That's the only one I happen to remember. And if that happened to get the same response, then we know that we're pretty much on the same side.
Uh-huh. And I remember you had mentioned to me, when you landed, you'd lost your gun, you'd lost your helmet, and you had the feeling that you weren't alone.
Well, and I just cut out of my shoe, and I still had my knife in my hand, and I was looking around to see if I could find somebody, and I felt a sense of someone coming up on me, and I thought it was one of our guys. Turned around, it was a German coming toward me, and he probably, now this is a supposition on my part as well, thought I was some dumb farmer that was out there watching all the fun, or I don't know what else he could have thought, because I didn't have a helmet, didn't have a rifle, and I'd made a turnaround just as he picked his gun up to fire. I charged in there, hit it aside, and they had taught us when we go to hand-to-hand combat to aim for just below the sternum and go up, give a jerk up as hard as you can so that you'll hit all the vital items and vital insight. And I thought I'd done that until I tried to withdraw the knife, and I couldn't get it out, so I must have gone right into his sternum, and so I got out of there.
You got out of there. You don't know what happened.
I don't know about him. I think he was in trouble. I don't know if he lived or died.
So eventually, you ended up in German hands. How did that happen?
Well, a lot of intercessions that went along. We would run into groups and have just a fire exchange. And I just want to mention one of them, which would probably be with me till the day that I die. We'd had a lot of firefights, and this one was, we were on the side of a road, and there was some squad coming down the road, the German people, and they were evidently not concerned about us being around because they had their rifles slung, and they were walking along kind of talking to one another, about six or eight of them. And we signaled each other to which one you take. You take one, you get two, three. We did that, and I had about the fourth one in the line. And then they said fire, and then we opened up on them, and after that was over, went down to see what they were and where they were going, if there was anything we could use in there. Because we had a limited amount of ammunition to use, and we were very close to being without it right then. And I looked at the young man that I hit, and it turns out that he was a young man, and I wasn't a good shot. It just glanced along his left side, cut his jugular vein, and took off half of his jaw, and he was laying there with blood spurting out in his eyes, going through the rigors of death. When everything starts shutting down, that's one of those crazy things that happen, I guess. And seeing that kid laying there, and he really was, he was younger than I thought about my younger brother who was in the service back in the States, and I didn't know anything about him, and I thought, good Lord, what the dickens am I doing? This isn't fun. This is serious business, because here I've killed somebody, and that's in violation of all the religious beliefs I'd ever had. I said, not only that, now I'm condemned to hell because of thou shalt not kill, and I had. And old Salt came along and said, Coleman, I don't know anything about their politics, and I'm not so sure about ours, but I do know one thing. If we don't kill them, they're going to kill us. And so we moved on from there.
Did that stay with you for a long time?
Still does.
Later, Bill and several other soldiers were captured by the German army and sent to a POW camp. Near the end of the war, they escaped by just walking away. You can find a link to my complete 2007 conversation with Bill Coleman online at wmfe.org/intersection. There you can also sign up for our weekly podcast. Support for Intersection comes from our listeners. Amy Green is the assistant producer. I'm Mark Simpson, and thanks for listening.